Okay, let's get started. So our topic for tonight is the crisis of Jewish education among the Jewish immigrants 130, 140 years ago, among the great wave of Eastern European Jews in America. Last week, I mentioned the name Rabbi Moses Weinberger, who was a Hungarian rabbi who came to America in 1880, and in 1887 wrote a famous memoir of his, Hayehudim v'Hayadut b'New York, which was later translated into English as People Walk on Their Heads, in which he cried out about the state of religious affairs among Jews in New York 140, 130 years ago. He was worried about kashrut being a mess. He was worried about gittin, divorces, not being obtained properly, and there'd be mamzerim, bastard children born because of lack of religious divorces. But in all the technicalities of the Jewish religion, there were problems. But then he said, to be honest, none of this is going to matter anymore, because if we don't give our children a Jewish education, there won't be any identifying Jews a generation or two from now. So all the other issues would be petty by comparison. And basically, he was right. In the absence of inculcating Judaism and Jewish identity into the youth, there's not much to worry about the other details. So parents were not especially interested in their children becoming Talmudic scholars. If in the old world it was considered desirable for your son to become a Talmud Chacham, to achieve greatness, godless in Torah, well, that wasn't even on the radar among Jews in Lower East Side immigrant New York. Not at all. What did they want for their children? They wanted their children to have material success. And that begins in the public school. And the public school was known as the temple of Americanization, the temple of Americanization. Now, public schools had had a hold on American Jewry, on American Jewish youth, since about the 1830s, when they went non-denominational. But prior to that, there was not necessarily available public education, and whatever did exist might have been of an overtly Christian nature. But in the mid-19th century, the major urban areas in America, including New York, began to have non-denominational, free, tuition-free public schools. Isaac Leiser had wanted in the 1850s and 60s to recreate the all-day Jewish parochial schools that had existed in colonial times, but he found no success. We shall see that the Eastern European immigrants would create such a school, Eitz Chaim. I'll mention that shortly. Okay, so the immigrants are sending their kids to the public schools. And where are the kids going to get any Jewish education? Only in supplemental after-school environment. The supplemental after-school. The problem with those chadarim, the one-room cheder, after-school hours, is that kids don't really want to go. And they have other things they would rather do after 4 o'clock, whether it's play sports in the street, or go to the settlement houses and have cultural and recreational activities there under more organized auspices, or they have to go home and do homework. Now, when I say homework, I don't mean some math examples in a textbook. I mean work that you do at home, notably the needle trades work, where the sweatshops would pawn out itemized things for the family to do, and the mother or the father would do work at home during the daytime. And when the kid got home from school, he was also expected, or she was also expected, to get in on the action and do remunerative work, so-called homework. So all these were things that had priority in the after-school hours, much more so than Judaic instruction. So who taught in these chadarim, these little ad hoc Hebrew schools of the early immigrant period? Well, Hutchins Hapgood, who was a scholar of American sociology, a goy, he said that these people who taught in the Chadarim, they were submerged scholars who struggled for economic survival and popular approbation. In other words, they were scholars. They really knew a lot in their religion. They knew a lot of the Hebrew, the Talmud, the Bible, the Rashi, all these things. And people didn't appreciate what they were worth. That the average Jew, who was not even close to a scholar, thought of these malamdim as nobodies, deserving of no covered, barely deserving of a few pennies to pay for teaching the kid. So the submerged scholar does not afford the dignity that he deserves. So thought the outsider, Hutchins Hapgood. Now, however, there's another way of looking at it, and that is that the supplemental Jewish schools didn't fare well compared to the lure of entertainment beyond the cheder, and that the people teaching the cheder were pursuing the only occupation they knew from the old country, meaning they couldn't do anything else. All this person could do was be a malamed tinokos, and even that not all that well. And so there was no dignity, there was no covet, there was no honor, because they didn't deserve to be any. All right. And in the classroom, these men, who essentially were ignorant men selling whatever little knowledge they had, they scratched something on the board while the kids fought and played and didn't pay any attention. So this was the reality of the primitive chadarim. There's a question in the chat: what percentage of public school students went to chadarim? The answer is we don't really know. However, by 1904, it is thought that 75% of Jewish youth in New York got no religious education whatsoever, even not even a primitive cheder, let alone some of the more advanced styles of education. So it's a pretty low percentage. Well, what happens next? In 1884, Machzike Talmud Torah was established on the Lower East Side. Machzike Talmud Torah was in a commodious building. It had a large space, and it divided up the cheder along grade levels, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. So it wasn't all in one room, everyone of varying ages learning the same thing at the same time. So this was an improvement. It was located on East Broadway, and at its high point, they had 400 students. So this is not 10 boys in a room with a Rebbe. This is, 400 students in a more formal environment. Why was Machzike Talmud Torah so popular? Well, in part, it's because the Malbish Arumim Society gave away free clothes and free shoes to the students, that if you were indigent, you could get this education for free, courtesy of the philanthropists and the tzedakahs. Okay, so this was the reality of Jewish education. So Joanne asks, yes, it was boys only. The girls had to learn at home, absorbing whatever information they could from their mother and from osmosis. It would not be until a later date that there'd be formal religious education for girls in the Hebrew school setting. Okay, so after the Machzike Talmud Torah was established in 1884, this was not good enough for those parents who wanted their children, their boys, to get a more intense Judaic education. That in the after-school hours of 4 to 7 p.m., there's only so much you can learn. You wanted a full-day yeshiva program. So in 1886, Yeshivat Eitz Chaim was founded. Yeshivat Eitz Chaim, they would learn from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and the basis of the curriculum was the Talmud and the halachic writings, Shas and Poskim. Okay, at an elementary school level, but Gemara and halacha. After 4 p.m., then you had 2 hours of English instruction. And at 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., you had 1 hour of instruction in Hebrew language and Yiddish language. So you could ask, well, who's going to send their kid to this kind of school? Obviously, not people who have been acculturated or are assimilating, but rather those who are fresh off the boat and whose religious scruples are fully intact and who want their boy to have a rigorous Talmudic education. So why teach any English whatsoever? After all, in the old days in Europe, they didn't teach English or Russian in the cheder. I mean, only in the progressive ones, but we'll get to that soon. Why teach any English? The answer is because in 1874, New York State passed a law that required the teaching of spelling, reading, writing, English grammar, geography, and math to all young people below a certain age. That you weren't allowed to be delinquent if you're a parent. You couldn't be delinquent with your child in not giving them some measure of general studies education. And so, to satisfy New York State, 2 hours from 4 to 6 p.m. Eitz Chaim needed to raise money. Well, how do you raise money in an environment like the like the urban ghetto of the Lower East Side, where most people no longer value that kind of education, certainly not for their own children, and maybe not even for others. So what is the hook? What's the way you grab them and grab dollars out of their wallet? So I ask you a question. There are 67 people listening. Who knows? How do you grab some money out of somebody's wallet?
Bar mitzvah.
How do you do it?
Bar mitzvah.
So
a guilt trip.
That
lottery.
What was that?
Lottery. Lottery.
You could do that. What else?
Tax them.
Tax. So there's no possibility.
Make them feel guilty. That
anybody. But the answer is death. American Judaism survives on death. So he has a yard site. What do you promise to do? Learn Mishnayos and say Kaddish and light a little bulb on the wall with a plaque that says in memory of great grandpa Seymour or whatever. You know, you have various methods relating to death that will get people to give money to a yeshiva. Ad hayom hazeh, till our very day, I'm sure plenty of you who are listening here have given some charitable contribution in memory of a loved one to a yeshiva you never really heard of, but because they asked you and l'zeicha nishma, you'll do it. Okay. So that's a way of making money. But it turned out it was not all that successful. Why was it not all that successful? Number one, the masses are poor. A dedicating windows. Someone in the chat mentioned dedicating windows. That's absolutely true. That's a big one. You can charge a lot for windows. So number one, the hamonam, the masses are very poor and they don't have a lot to give. And even the nouveau riche, and there are nouveau riche, as we mentioned last week, those who built the cathedral synagogues of the downtown and hired fancy chazanim for $1,000 a pop. Okay, there were people with money, but they were being bombarded with solicitations from a wide range of charities, and given to Yeshivat Eitz Chaim wasn't at the top of their list. Okay. By 1905, there were only 150 students at Eitz Chaim. So the school had been in existence for almost 20 years, and it only had 150 kids. And it was one of, at that point, only two elementary yeshivas on the Lower East Side. And can you imagine a community that had hundreds of thousands of Jews could only have 150 kids in the yeshiva? It's an embarrassment. It's a bizayon. Well, the truth of the matter is, even the people who you might have thought were prime candidates to attend the school sometimes did not attend the school. So I'll give you an example. And for those of you who were learning with me, you know, a few years back, we did Mordechai Kaplan. So I mentioned this little anecdote in Kaplan's life. Kaplan's father was Rabbi Israel Kaplan. His mother was Anna Kaplan. They came to America around 1890 when Mordechai was about 9 years old. And they came to America because Israel Kaplan was going to be a dayan on the Beis Din, on the court of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the chief rabbi. So you would figure that if a person is a dayan on a Beis Din, he's very frum and he's going to want his child to grow up in the tradition and receive a rigorous Talmudic education. So it would make sense for Mordechai Kaplan as a young boy to go to Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. Well, he did for less than a year. And then his parents pulled him out and he went to public school. And then he went to JTS and simultaneously to high school, the CCNY high school, then City College, and then a graduate degree at Columbia. So why was he pulled out of Eitz Chaim? Well, the answer appears to be that his mother, Anna, wanted her son to become the chief rabbi of England one day. Now, granted, they're Lithuanian Jews living in New York, but she wants her son to be the chief rabbi of England. So it's like a little bit going around in circles here. But that's what she wanted. So therefore, it was necessary for him to learn to speak the King's English, or rather New York public school English, rather than the yeshivish English of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. And therefore, he was pulled out of the school. Now, it also happens to be the case that his father, Israel Kaplan, was a maskil. Was an Orthodox maskil, someone who's a devotee of the Haskalah, of the Enlightenment. He wasn't just an old world rabbi with a long beard who didn't know any general knowledge. He had some general knowledge, and so it wouldn't surprise that he wanted a more well-rounded curriculum for his child. And so Mordechai Kaplan had a more robust secular education than had he remained in Eitz Chaim for the long haul. Now, just as a complete aside, it's well known among those who know the history that Kaplan went to Eitz Chaim at least briefly. Why? Because Eitz Chaim, as we will explain tonight, is the precursor to Yeshiva University. The Yeshiva University, the university dates from 1946 as a college from 1928, as a combined school from 1915, Reitz from 1897. But the original core of Yeshiva University was the elementary school Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, 1886. And for the 90th anniversary of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim or Yeshiva University, the public affairs department, the public relations department, sent out notices to try to find who was the oldest living alumni of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, of Yeshiva University. And it turned out it was none other than Mordechai Kaplan, who was at that time 95 years old. So they were going to make a halt to do publicity about it. They canceled all the publicity. Okay. Now, what happens next? In the 1890s, the spirit of America entered into the Yeshiva of Eitz Chaim. People realized, yes, I want my kid to have a strong Judaic education, but it has to be that the kid will be able to earn a livelihood after he graduates. So there must be some general education which is worth receiving. But who's going to teach these subjects? Who can you trust to teach secular subjects to yeshiva boys, impressionable young yeshiva boys? Well, answer my question for me. Who knows the answer? Who's going to teach secular education to impressionable young yeshiva boys? What kind of person?
When I taught in public school, I got yeshiva jobs teaching English after school to make ends meet.
Okay, good. So it's a standard thing that Jewish public school teachers like to moonlight in the yeshivas after hours. That makes sense from the perspective of the teacher. But from the perspective of the yeshiva, what kind of such teacher, what type of person in particular would they be looking for?
Well, expert in his field, but...
No, baloney. They don't care about expert in the field.
Willing to take a lower, remuneration.
Lower remuneration is a key. They don't
have orthodox.
Orthodox, correct, Seth, good. So they want people whom they can trust not to teach apikorsus, heresy, to the young boys in the course of general education. After all, you could teach evolution, you could teach all sorts of reproductive sexual science to boys who are not ready for it yet. All sorts of things exist in limudei chol, the secular subjects, that might be damaging to the psyche and to the religious development of the impressionable yeshiva bachur. So therefore, make sure whoever you're going to hire is a reliably Orthodox Jew. Well, is it so easy to find such people? No, it's not, actually. Especially though, not if you want to pay very, very low wages. So it often was the case that people who had other ideological agendas were teaching in Eitz Chaim. For example, Abraham Kahan. Who's Abraham Kahan? The publisher of The Forward. Okay, a socialist, a socialist. Now, can we have a socialist teaching yeshiva boys? That doesn't sound very good. So Abe Kahn was fired because he didn't pass muster ideologically once they realized we better be careful about who we hire to teach English subjects. Okay, but ultimately then, Eitz Chaim wasn't doing a good job of teaching secular studies to the kids. And another school developed or opened in 1901. And this was because Samuel Andron had a couple of boys, and one of them was going to Eitz Chaim, and one of them was going to public school. And the one who went to public school asked for money in the middle of December to help pay for the Christmas party in his public school classroom. And the father says, "Oy, veiz mir, money for Christmas parties? I can't send my kid to public school." Ah, but he doesn't want to send him to Eitz Chaim, because in Eitz Chaim the kids don't get a good secular education. So what do we have to do? We have to create a real, essentially, modern Orthodox day school. And what was created was Beit Sefer Tiferet Yerushalayim. Tiferet Yerushalayim. What is that known as today?
MTJ.
Incorrect, incorrect. Okay, so MTJ is Mesifta Tiferet Yerushalayim, which was established in 1906 as a yeshiva downtown, East Broadway. However, Beit Sefer Tiferes Yerushalayim, which preempted it by 5 years, a year later would be renamed Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, RJ, named after Rabbi Yaakov Yosef after he died. So RJJ began not as some right-wing school, but rather as a progressive alternative to Eitz Chaim, right? In 1904, Eitz Chaim opened up an afternoon program for public school kids from 4 to 7, because the school realized that most of the religious families in the neighborhood are not willing to give up on the public school education and are not willing to just give their kids 2 hours of afternoon English studies. They want, you know, rigorous English curriculum that the school can't offer them. But these same families also are interested in their kids learning Talmud and Halacha and not just getting the very weak Judaic education of the Cheder or even of the Machzikei Talmud Torah. So from 4 to 7, afternoon school to study Halacha and Gemara. But it didn't really work out all that well. And it would be another generation before the downtown Orthodox crowd recognized how they could accommodate the sincere religious needs and educational needs of those who are not so cloistered and narrow in their thinking. There's a question in the chat, did the Reform temples have school programs, after-school programs in those years? The answer is many of them did, yes. Okay, so what happens next? Rabbi Moses Meir Matlin arrived in 1890, also to serve on the Beis Din of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. And he started classes for graduates of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim and was joined in this endeavor by Yehuda David Bernstein and David Abramowitz. So it was began just as private classes for teenagers who finished Eitz Chaim and wanted to learn a little bit more. It was named Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary in 1897 in memory of the recently deceased Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the chief rabbi of Kovno, and who had been one of the few great rabbis to encourage his Talmidim to move to America. The certificate of incorporation said that the purpose of this REITS, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, was to prepare students for the Orthodox Hebrew ministry and that there would be a teacher who would give instruction in the language of the land. Orthodox Hebrew ministry and instruction in the language of the land. Well, the reality is that didn't happen. In truth, this was not a rabbinical seminary in the sense of like a Western European rabbinical seminary or like JTS was, or even Hebrew Union College, where the goal was to pump out rabbis, to produce, manufacture rabbis for the active ministry. Not at all. This was a transplanted Eastern European yeshiva, which meant that the goal of the yeshiva was Torah lishma, studying Torah for its own sake. Torah lishma. And there was no English instruction. Reitz struggled to find a permanent home in its early years, and it moved 5 times in the first 7 years of its existence until eventually it settled at 156 Henry Street. There's a question in the chat, did shuls have after-school programs? The answer is most of them did not, at least not yet. Some did, many more wouldn't by the 1920s and 30s. Okay, now who attended REITS? Who would go for an advanced yeshiva in America in the late 1890s, early 1900s? So the answer is, from among the children of the immigrant population, not very many. Okay, not very many were capable of studying an advanced yeshiva because they didn't have the elementary background. The Eitz Chaim kids did, but that's about it. So who then went to REITS? Many of the people who went through its doors were newly arrived immigrants who had yeshiva training in Europe. And some of them were already ordained rabbis or certified shochtim. They were clay kodesh, so to speak. Why did they go to the REITS yeshiva when they got to New York? The answer is, what else are they going to do? In other words, they love learning Torah. They're a ben Torah from the yeshivas of Europe. For personal reasons, for economic reasons, they had to make their way across the ocean to America, and they need a soft landing. Well, there's no softer landing for a yeshiva boy than to go to yeshiva for a little while. So that's what they did, and including many big names, including Bernard Revel, who would eventually come back as the president of the yeshiva. So they came to REITS for emotional and financial support, but truth be told, REITS didn't have that much money to give them. REITS prospects for long-term survival improved dramatically in 1903 when it became the favored charity of the Agudas Rabbanim. The Agudas Rabbanim was founded in 1902. It's the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. There were 60 founding rabbis all over the country who were, you know, old world Eastern European rabbis who held positions in big and small cities around the United States. And their favorite charity was the Yeshiva Yitzchak Elchanan, because that was, you know, the old world spirit transplanted into America. In 1904, the Agudas Rabbanim established a smicha board for REITs that, yes, the school has its directors and its administration, but we, the Agudas Rabbanim, are going to decide who gets ordained as a rabbi from this school. That we'll have a board of three, a panel of three rabbis to be a smicha board, and we'll figure out who gets the cloth. Okay. But there were rumblings and grumblings among the student body of REITs as early as 1901. The question in the chat, did anyone learn full-time in Europe or in the U.S. at the turn of the century? So the answer is yes. In the yeshivas of Eastern Europe, you had people who learned full-time. There weren't that many of them. The sum total population of all the great yeshivas of Poland and Lithuania and you know, Russia never probably amounted to more than about 5,000 people, if that many. Probably is a lot less than that. But they did learn full-time. And in America, other than at REITs, the answer is no. Okay, so... In 1901, there were those who wanted English language instruction in addition to their Talmudic studies. And there was a concern among the directors that if we give an inch, if we give a little bit of English studies at REITs, then what will happen is the yeshiva will just be a stopover place for boys on their way to other careers other than the rabbinate, meaning the boy has his eye on medicine, the law, engineering, journalism, and he's going to study on the side to entry exams for the colleges. And the yeshiva is like just something he does for fun, just for a little while, but it's not taking it too seriously. And they didn't want that to be the case. Now, some of the boys actually did go to city high schools in addition to learning at the yeshiva. Others were entirely autodidactic. And one such example led to a funny story. This is recorded in Jeff Gurok's Men and Women of Yeshiva. He said that one of the boys in the yeshiva learned English by reading the King James Bible. Now, by the way, this is a great way to learn a language. I never learned Yiddish as a kid because my family were in America 100 years. So when I had to learn Yiddish in graduate school, the best way to learn Yiddish for me was to read the Chumash in Yiddish, because I knew the Chumash, the Hebrew, essentially by heart from my years as a kid. In Yiddish, I would learn Yiddish. So the yeshiva boy wanted to learn English. So he read the King James Bible. But because of that, he had a warped English. And one time he was complaining that his landlord didn't provide light in the tenement. The tenement was dark. And so he said in King Jamesian English, "My anger is kindled against the Lord of the house for hastening to extinguish the small luminary." So that was his English, because he read the King James Bible. All right. Well, the students, they want something. They want more than just Talmudic studies. And in 1904, they were briefly placated by having an hour of English language instruction in the afternoons. But those classes were given by a 16-year-old boy who was a native-born American Jew living downtown, and then it was quickly done away with. It was quickly dispensed with. So the yeshiva said, "We're going to withhold your stipend if you spend too much time on English and not enough time on Talmud. So there's a threat here. You better shape up. Learn only Gemara. Don't learn English." Okay. So in 1906, in the winter, the students go on strike. There's a student strike at REITs. It's a battle with the fanatics, as they call it. They knew that modern Orthodox rabbis existed. And they wanted to be modern Orthodox rabbis. There's a question in the chat. Didn't our sages all have secular careers in addition to their understanding of the texts? Well, yes, in the Talmudic times, there were blacksmiths and coppersmiths and farmers and the like. And in medieval times, some of them were doctors. But in more modern times, typically not. So these yeshiva boys at REITs, they knew that there was a possibility of being a modern Orthodox rabbi, because such people did exist. And in a few minutes, we'll discuss what was modern Orthodoxy back then. These were the men associated with the OU and with the Jewish Theological Seminary, JTS. And it was certainly the case that there was no future for an old world rabbi in the new world, especially one educated in the new world. So if you're going to be educated in an American yeshiva, you had better become an American rabbi. Well, in order to become an American rabbi, your school has to give you the tools to do that. You have to be able to give a sermon in the English language, have to know how to be a pastoral leader. You can't just be poskening shilas about the kashrus of chickens. Okay, so among the senior rabbis in New York, there were some who supported the student strike, including Philip Hillel Klein, the rabbi of Ohr HaTzedek, OZ, the Ramaz, Rav Moshe Zvulun Margulies, the rabbi of KJ, and Tzvi Hirsch Mazliansky, one of the great Magidim downtown. The REITs directors decided to throw a bone to the students. They made the Ramaz president of the yeshiva, and they made Klein the honorary president. But nothing really changed, because these positions actually did not affect the day-to-day operating of the school. So the strike resumed in 1908 in May. Why did the strike resume? Well, a bunch of students politely went into the director's office and demanded that the two-year-old promise from 1906 finally be fulfilled. What did they want? Organized Talmud classes. Now, when I say organized Talmud classes, what do I mean? So anyone who's been to a yeshiva knows that there's a lot of haphazardness to the yeshiva. You know, you study b'chavrusa with a partner in the mornings, and then there's a shir from a rebbe, Rosh Yeshiva at some point, and then you study b'chavrusa in the afternoon, and there's a night seder. There's a lot of a time when you're on your own. And in some yeshivas, there really isn't a very organized system of the shiurim. You know, when the rebbe wants to give a class, he'll give a class. So what the students of REITs wanted was a clear schedule of this is what we do this hour, and this hour, and this hour, with the shiurim at the appropriate time and the appropriate levels. So they wanted that. They also wanted secular studies, most importantly, English language. And they wanted homiletics. I need to learn how to give a speech, because otherwise I can't compete with the students graduating from Schechter's seminary, Solomon Schechter's JTS. Okay, they're producing competent modern style rabbis, including of an Orthodox variety. And we just can't compete with them because we look like primitives by comparison. Okay. So after this petition was, you know, nailed to the door of the director of the Menahel, 15 boys who petitioned the yeshiva were immediately expelled. Why? So for chutzpah was the accusation, and the accusation that they were tainted with socialism. Whenever you want to besmirch someone, especially in an Orthodox Jewish environment, what do you say? Socialism. He's a socialist. Okay. So publicly, the directors said that they were short on money and that they had to reduce the enrollment simply for lack of funds. That was the saving face argument rather than to say that we maliciously expelled people just for asking what was reasonable. Now, the Yiddishes Tageblatt, the Orthodox newspaper downtown, and its editor, Caspiel Saracen, took up the cause of the students on the editorial page. And there was a great, you know, screaming and yelling that the retest to accommodate its students. So a deal was struck at KJ, in the boardroom at KJ on 85th Street, that REITs would become a place of Torah and Chachma. What's the slogan of Yeshiva University? What's the slogan?
Torah v'mada.
Torah v'mada. So that's invented much later. In the beginning, it was Torah u'chachma, Torah and wisdom. And this newly formed REITs would be sponsored by Harry Fischel, who was the Eastern European and Orthodox Jacob Schiff, okay, and A.Z. Lewin Epstein, who was the head of Carmel Wine Company. That these two Reiche mentioned, rich guys, would underwrite much of the REITs budget. Bernard Leventhal, the rabbi from Philadelphia, who also had an accommodationist bent, he was made president of the faculty. So with Klein and Ramaz and Leventhal all supporting a modernized REITs, you would figure that change was afoot, that something would happen. Now, some wondered whether the Agudas HaRabbanim would want to continue being the patrons of REITs if and the head of the Smicha board if in fact this yeshiva was going to no longer be an old world yeshiva, but rather was going to have secular studies and be an Americanized institution. All right, but the bottom line is they continue to participate because Klein, Rabbi Margulies, and Leventhal were the heavy hitters in the Agudas Rabbanim also. So the marriage continued. But how could they support a yeshiva with secular studies? After all, didn't the Volozhin yeshiva close in 1892 rather than capitulate to the Tsarist wishes that they teach secular studies? Now, the truth is that's a myth. It didn't really happen that way, and we're not going to get into that now, but that's the myth everybody tells, that Volozhin closed because they didn't want to teach secular studies. But in fact, there was precedent. Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, already as early as 1882, had proposed the creation of a yeshiva in Eastern Europe that would have Limudei Chol, secular studies. It failed in 1882, but in 1905, it was successful, and it was established at Lida. Okay, so there was a modern style yeshiva in Eastern Europe that predates Ritz being modernized in New York. So there was precedent. Also, what's relevant is that Reines is famous for what politically? Who knows? What did he establish? What nationalistic organization did he establish?
Mizrahi.
Correct. He's the founder of Mizrahi, and the Agudas HaRabbanim are not ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionist fundamentalists. The Agudas HaRabbanim in America, even though they're old world rabbis with long beards and hats, they're all Mizrahi, almost all Mizrahi. Right? So because Reines was the leader of Mizrahi and he had a yeshiva with secular studies, then it's okay if in America we also have to have a yeshiva with secular studies. It's not ideal, but you know, if we have to capitulate, we'll capitulate. Okay, so that would seem to be the direction the school was going in. However, instead, there was almost another strike because no real changes actually happened. The REITs ran out of money and the school closed in the summer of 1908. And while it was closed, so what are the students going to do? Some of the students got on the train, went uptown to Morningside Heights, and never turned around. What did they do? They went to JTS. So many of the great rabbis of the conservative movement of the early first half of the 20th century were students at Ritz who left yeshiva, went to Schechter Seminary, and became big-time American rabbis. Others did not want to go to Ritz, they did not want to go to JTS, but they wanted to learn. So in the interregnum, in the dead time, in the summer of 1908, a new school, an ephemeral institution was established. It was known as the Yeshiva LeRabbanim of East Broadway, the East Broadway Yeshiva for Rabbis. And who ran it? Mazliansky, Shalom Elchanan Yafi, and Shalom Rabinovitz. They established a yeshiva which promised to have secular subjects and a well-rounded Judaica curriculum. It reopened a few weeks later, and the yeshiva of East Broadway ceased to exist. The returning students were faced with a test, two tests, actually. One was, were you studying while the yeshiva was closed? We're going to give you a faher, an exam, on the 20 pages of Talmud you were supposed to have studied while you were on vacation. That's the first test. The second test was an ideological litmus test. Are you going to cause trouble and pursue secular education? Or are you going to toe the party line and just have yeshiva studies? And if you don't give the right answer, you can't come back to yeshiva. So even though there had been, you know, these protests and strikes and support from big shots in the Agudas HaRabbanim, Ritz basically held out as a hardline institution, not wanting to give in to forces of Americanization, at least not yet. Okay. Well, the student population declined dramatically. Between 1908 and 1913, while it was not accommodating the American trend, the student population went down by half, and there were only 55 students in Ritz in 1913. Although one of them, I think, was my great-grandfather, who studied in yeshiva briefly on the Lower East Side until he got headaches because he needed glasses. But I'm pretty sure he studied at Ritz. So in 1912, a merger agreement was reached in principle between Eitz Chaim and Ritz to have shared finances to merge the institutions, and that Eitz Chaim would be a feeder school for Ritz. In 1915, this merger was finalized, and the question was, who will lead the institution? It's going to be an Americanized school Well, they hired Bernard Revel. So a couple of years back, we spent the whole session on the career of Bernard Revel. Just a few quick details about him. He's born in Lithuania in 1885. He is an Eloi, a Talmudic genius in the yeshivas of Eastern Europe. He dabbled in socialism when he was 19 years old, was expelled from Russia, came to the United States around 1906, and learned briefly at Reitz, then went to NYU, then went to Dropsy, where he got his PhD in Karaite studies, where he defended the tradition against the assaults by Abraham Geiger. And he married a wealthy girl from Tulsa, from the Travis family in the oil business. And then at the age of 30, he became the president and Rosh Yeshiva of the newly merged Reitz Eitz Chaim. The school was renamed Rabbinical College of America, RCA, as opposed to the contemporary Rabbinical College of America, which is a Chabad yeshiva in Morristown, New Jersey. Okay, what did Revel do to make the school a strong institution? So number one, he bolstered the Talmudic faculty by hiring big name Rosh Yeshiva out of Europe, including the Meitzer Eloi, and then later Reb Moshe Soloveitchik in the late 1920s. So, but also he hired Judaic studies people for Bible, history, philosophy, all sorts of subjects that in a real regular yeshiva you would never touch. In a real yeshiva, you never touch history, you never touch philosophy, Bible, Hebrew. No, it's all treif. You can't touch that. But in a modernized yeshiva, you can. And who does he get to teach these things? Orthodox Jews who have doctorates in the various fields of study. And he hires Rabbi Bernard Drachman and Rabbi Henry Pereira Mendes as professors of and public speaking. So what ended up happening was by 1916, the old modern Orthodox crowd had made its way into Reitz, into what will become Yeshiva University. So if you think of today Yeshiva University as a modern Orthodox institution, well, you have to understand how it got that way. Reitz was an old world Eastern European yeshiva that morphed into something more modern, and that the old line modern Orthodox eventually were brought in by Bernard Revel. So now let me explain to you what was the old modern orthodoxy. Well, in the mid-1880s, downtown, there were two different types of people who were calling themselves orthodox. There was the Rabbi Yaakov Yosef crowd and the downtown synagogues, the Landsman Shaften and the cathedral synagogues of the Big Chazanim, who hired a chief rabbi, and it didn't go well, as we said. So that's the Eastern European Orthodoxy. And the Agudat Rabbanim emerges from that rabbinate. But the modern Orthodoxy were the crowd that joined together with the conservatives to form JTS. That I mentioned last week, JTS was an amalgamation of the middle of the roaders, meaning the moderate reformers, or what we call conservative or positive historical guys, and the Sephardic Orthodox, like Sherith Israel, Rabbi Henry Pereira Mendes, and the central European Orthodox, like Bernard Drachman. So the modern Orthodox crowd, they established the Orthodox Union in 1898, which was designed to fight off reform and also to promote traditional Judaism in America. But the argument was by the Eastern European crowd that the Western European Orthodox, the so-called modern Orthodox, the OUJTS guys, they no constituency. There were no Orthodox people uptown who were interested in being ministered to by these kinds of rabbis. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much of an exaggeration, because Drachman himself could hardly find a job. When he came back from seminary in Germany in 1885, he went to a shul in Newark, and they wanted to get rid of the mechitza, so he resigned rather than have a shul with no mechitza. He couldn't find a job. His father-in-law built a shul for him. That shul became Zichron Ephraim, which became Parkey Synagogue. Okay, so it wasn't easy for the modern Orthodox to find a clientele. And the Eastern Europeaners basically said, these guys have nobody, so they come downtown looking for business. There is truth to it. Who are the people who came downtown? So the answer is the Jewish Endeavor Society, which was the youth wing of the OU. These were students and recent graduates of JTS who were Orthodox rabbis. We're talking about an early Mordechai Kaplan, Julius Greenstone, and others, Henry Moraes, Joseph Herman Hertz, These were early graduates of the seminary, both pre-Schefter and early Schefter years, who go downtown and make model synagogues, young people's synagogues, where there's congregational singing, where there's no commercialization of the shul, where there's English prayers, where there's a sermon, an edifying sermon in English. So these are modern style worship services for the young people downtown, the children of immigrants who grew up in America and don't like the old Landsmannschaft shuls and couldn't care less about the big chazonim. They wanted an Americanized shul. So this was early modern orthodoxy. It lasted for about a decade, the Jewish Endeavor Society, and then it was followed by, in 1912, Young Israel. But Young Israel was the successor, catering to the younger, Americanized, yet still Orthodox crowd downtown and elsewhere in the second areas of settlement in Brooklyn and uptown. So this was an Americanized Orthodoxy. How did Americanized Orthodoxy get along with the Agudas Rabbanim and the Old World Orthodoxy? The answer is sometimes uncomfortably. They could not cooperate on all issues, which might have meant redundancies, but it didn't mean any redundancies. Because for you guys, they focused on defending the rights of traditional Jews in modern America. So that what? Civil service exams shouldn't take place on Saturday. Regents exams shouldn't take place on Saturday or should have an alternative date. That kids who go to public school, if they want to take off on Yom Tovim, should not be expelled or punished. The blue laws should be abolished or lessened in their severity. So all this sort of public advocacy on behalf of Jews who are Shomer Mitzvot and have to worry about all this stuff, about Shabbos and holidays and work and school, that was the OU's bailiwick. What was the Agudas Rabbanim concerned with? They were concerned with kashrus and the meat factories and details of religious observance. And so to put it in a certain way, ultimately, the Agudas Rabbanim was less concerned that American law respect the immigrant Jew, and more interested that the new American continued to respect Jewish law. So that's a nice pithy way of saying Agudas Rabbanim wanted you to be frum, and OU wanted to make sure that you could be frum in an American context. Okay, so three types of rabbis who welcome in the Agudas Rabbanim. What kind of rabbis are we talking about? So one is the unqualified rabbi. As Professor Gurak calls him, Reverend Samuel Distillator. In other words, the guy who makes booze in his bathroom on the side. He does weddings, he gives speeches, he does bar mitzvahs, he does a bris, he kills a chicken without any qualifications whatsoever, but he's doing it. And maybe even doing it not a bad job of it. But he's technically unqualified. That person is not welcome in the Agudas Rabbanim, not a real rabbi. Who else is not welcome? The politically uncooperative rabbi. Who's the politically uncooperative rabbi? Well, last week I mentioned that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef had competitors as the chief rabbi, that Rabbi Vidrowitz and Rabbi Yoshua Siegel claim to be chief rabbi of America or chief rabbi of New York or this and that. They claim titles for themselves. They're welcome to join the Agudas Rabbanim. Why not? Because they were independent operators and they did not want their fiefdom in the abattoir and in the butcher house to be compromised by some ecclesiastical combine that's going to boss them around. No, I have my kashrus fiefdom. Get bread on me. That was their attitude. And they had followings, especially among early Hasidim in America. Rabbi Yeshua Siegel, he was famous for writing a sefer, Eruv V'Hotzah, in which he claimed legitimacy for the Lower East Side Eruv. Now, what's the legitimacy of the Lower East Side Eruv? He didn't build an Eruv. There was no wires. So how could it be an Eruv in the Lower East Side? Anybody know?
The L train.
Bingo. Good. That there's water on three sides and the L train on the fourth side. So since there's a seawall around this way and there is an elevated train with pillars, which was Alechi and Korah, so therefore you could carry on the Lower East Side. That was his psak and his chassidim followed him. I said they were the politically non-cooperative rabbis, and they were not welcome because they were doing their own thing. But the third category of rabbi who wasn't welcome in the Agudas Rabbanim is the American Orthodox rabbi. Why? Because these people were not given ordination by one of the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. Rather, where do they get their ordination from? Either JTS, which in the eyes of the Agudas Rabbanim was not a legitimate rabbinical school, or maybe even from a Western European seminary of some kind, also not kosher in their eyes. And even if it's not even an issue of kosher, they're not sufficiently learned in Shas and Poskim. They're not great scholars. They just know a little bit. So therefore, they can't join. Now, as it turned out, the Agudas Rabbanim would then go on to say that even if you graduate from Reitz, you can't join. But isn't Reitz a legitimate yeshiva? Don't they sponsor Reitz and their smicha board takes care of the students? Well, they ruled you had to have not only yora smicha, but also yadin yadin. You had to have the higher level ordination. And since Reitz didn't give that, you weren't welcome. So American Orthodox rabbis are out. You can't join our organization. A big question emerged whether or not American Orthodoxy could cooperate with the non-Orthodox in pursuing improvements in Jewish education. I've mentioned in the last few weeks the New York Kehillah a bunch of times. And the Kehillah had the Board of Jewish Education. And they very much wanted the Orthodox rabbis to be co-opted into this organization. Can you trust the German Reform Jews, German Reform money, be a factor in improving the cheder situation for downtown Orthodoxy? And some said we can't trust them. As tempting as it is to get their money, still we have to worry about them having a deleterious influence on our religious agenda. But ultimately, the OU crowd was willing to cooperate, and even the Agudas Rabbanim crowd, at least for a little while, was willing to cooperate. So 23 out of the 46 New York area rabbis who were members of the Agudath, they joined the Vad HaRabbanim of the New York Kehillah in 1912. And the reason they did so was because they were promised a monopoly over mikveh, milah, kashrus, all the technicalities of religious observance, stuff that the downtown Orthodox had always wanted Rabbi Yaakov Yosef to resolve and to address and to correct. Now, finally, there'd be an institutional backing and money to make that possible. But the relationship broke down when the Orthodox rabbis tried to stick their hand and whatever else in educational matters. And there, Judah Magnus and the reformers wanted the Orthodox out. You're not in charge of Jewish education. That's going to be given over to Samson Benderly, who is a professional pedagogue. A doctorate of education who had ideas about the future of Jewish education for the masses of American Jewry who were no longer traditional Orthodox. Okay, so the classic institution where the role of the Kehillah was important and Orthodox Jews played a dominant role was the Uptown Talmud Torah. The Uptown Talmud Torah was in Harlem, and Harlem for a while was Jewish. We're going to spend a session, I think in 2 weeks from now, discussing Jewish Harlem. But the Uptown Talmud Torah, which was at first just an old world cheder, but by the late 1890s, early 1900s, had become a modernized Talmud Torah, was a school for several hundred kids, and they were going to use the most modern methods of pedagogy and modern and standards of hygiene. So Jacob Schiff, who was a big supporter of this school, he brought in technology to teach the Bible. What was the technology of 1910? A slideshow, projection, you know, projecting images, not moving images, but pictures on a screen. And by those standards, that was like, you know, having the internet in the classroom, having a smart board of today. What happened? Some of the old world types, including the parents, didn't like the idea of technology in the classroom. Like today, by the Frum, they don't want to have the internet. So what happened? One night, a parent of one of the kids in the Uptown Talmud Torah snuck into the building and destroyed the slide machine. And they came the next day, and they found the vandalism. And Jacob Schiff said, "Oi, brach, what happened here? You know, I'm dealing with people who are fanatics and who don't want to have any measure of progress." So that was the sort of thing that schools had to deal with of an old world attitude among some of the parent body and some of the rabbis who were involved, but more modern ideas about how to run institutions of Talmud Torah. Okay, so ultimately, we only have a few minutes left, you know, most Jews did not most kids didn't want to go to Talmud Torah. Most kids were not interested in Jewish education, and a lot of them didn't get one. The vast majority didn't get. So how do you attract these people to the synagogue if they grew up in immigrant quarters in Jewish New York and yet have wenig Yiddishkeit in them, very little Jewishness, very little Jewish religious identity in them? What do we do about it? So among the major Orthodox rabbis, there was an awareness that you need to have an assistant rabbi who speaks the language of the people and can attract that younger generation, that less pious generation. Well, where are you going to get these rabbis from? The answer is, who's producing modern Orthodox rabbis? JTS, not REITs. And so at KJ, for example, the Ramaz was one of the high priest of Judaism in New York. He was like the chief rabbi of New York, not literally, but figuratively. He was one of the big, big rabbanim of New York, and deservedly so. It was a major Talmid Chacham. So who did he hire, or rather who worked with him at KJ? First was Guy Kaplan, JTS class of 1902. After that was Herbert Goldstein, JTS class of 1911. After that was Elias Solomon, JTS class of 1918. So here the Ramaz was willing to cooperate with seminary graduates to try to attract the younger generation, English speaking, and that doesn't have the same intense fervor and commitment as do the older Yiddish speaking parent and grandparent generations. By the way, it's a sign of the success of REITs in becoming an American institution that after Elias Solomon was the assistant rabbi at KJ, the next person to be hired was whom? Who knows? Joseph, who? Lookstein. Joseph Lookstein, REITs class of 1923, was the next assistant rabbi. The fact that that Ramaz went from hiring a seminary person to a REITs person proved the point that REITs was now an American yeshiva that produced American rabbis. And you no longer had to go to JTS. In fact, you shouldn't, because now they're utterly conservative. Okay. Well, what do these young rabbis offer the people? Herbert Goldstein, while at KJ, established the Central Jewish Institute, which was a cultural programming, educational and cultural and social, that brought people within the orbit of the synagogue without a truly religious flavor to it. If you came for secular programming, you would eventually come for religious content as well. Then he moved uptown to Harlem and established the Institutional Synagogue. And then he moved to the Upper West Side, where it became the West Side Institutional Synagogue, WSIS, which is still to this day on 76th Street. That was one thing. The other was Mordechai Kaplan, another one of the KJ assistant rabbi alumni. And what did he do? He established the Jewish Center. The Jewish Center is the shul with a pool, the shul with a gym. The idea being that if you bring in the athleticers, as Kaplan called them, to your building, they'll come to lift weights and to swim in the pool and to play basketball, and eventually they'll mosey on over into the sanctuary in Daven Shmoneh Esrei, or maybe they will. So these were some of the ideas that are already developing in the 19-teens and will come to fruition in the 1920s, 30s, and beyond, in the interwar period and later, but they already have their origins around the time of World War I. So this is the story of education, Jewish education, from an Orthodox perspective in the era of the Great Wave, and the sort of the competition between the old line rabbis and the newer type rabbis, and the degree of cooperation or lack of cooperation that happened at that time. Okay, any questions?
Yeah, when did Manhattan Day School start?
I think Manhattan Day School started in 1941, if I'm not mistaken.
Herbert Goldstein was an agudist.
Herbert Goldstein was an agudist. He was not a Mizrahi type, he had long attachments to the world of Brooklyn Orthodoxy, because that was his personal flavor. Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
Two questions. Actually, I thought OU was started by Goldstein.
No. So OU was founded in 1898 by Bernard Drachman and Henry Pereira Mendes. Goldstein founded Central Jewish Institute and then a bunch of shuls.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, you mentioned the the unfamiliarity of modern rabbis, and you didn't mention the template of Rabbi Hirsch from Frankfurt, because he had a yeshiva in Germany, okay, and then later on, even in Washington Heights, where you had secular and Hebraic studies under one roof.
Correct, correct. However, it must be noted that Hirsch was not a great influence on the wider Jewish world outside of his own Frankfurt and Germanic, secessionist orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. His reputation in the 140 years after his death has grown, and he's regarded as an important figure when you study modern Jewish history. But in his time, and even after his time, really the Hirschian influence was only over his own community. So we're dealing with here downtown Orthodoxy, which is an Eastern European phenomenon. They have Samson Raphael Hirsch was.
What was the effect of the summer camps on Jewish education back then?
That happens later on. And in the interwar period, it will become a big deal. The Zionist camps in upstate New York, the Hebrew speaking camps, and then eventually later the Camp Ramah type camps. So we're too early for that. We will get to it in the interwar period.
And when was the high school attached to either Reitz or YU?
So the high school was established in 1916 as Talmudic Academy, a Regents accredited high school. That was Bernard Revel's major accomplishment. By creating a high school, it meant that those who wanted a secular education through the level could stay in the orbit of the yeshiva all the way until they were ready to go to college, and even then study in the yeshiva while they went to CCNY because the two were not that far apart. So the establishment of TA was a big, big deal. Of course, the next step after that was, well, if you have a high school, you also need a college, and Yeshiva College would follow in 1928.
Okay. Thank you.
We got time for one more? Anybody else?
What about the girls' yeshiva?
The girls' schools would not happen until after this period of time. The first Beis Yaakov wasn't until 1917. Mm-hmm. The Torahs of interwar Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Harlem, those would be co-ed, many of them, and girls would get education in the synagogue Talmud Torahs and in the big major Talmud Torahs. Those would offer education to girls. But as for day school education for girls, that would not happen until the 1930s.
When did the people from Manhattan emigrate to Brooklyn, for example?
It depends when you came to America. So some people went directly to Brooklyn, whether to East New York, Brownsville, Williamsburg, and some of that happened already in the 1890s. But certainly by the 1900s, there were people moving to these neighborhoods, some of whom directly and some of whom from the Lower East Side. When we discuss, in a few weeks, we'll discuss Harlem and other neighborhoods, the route. Where do you go? The answer is you follow the train tracks.
What about Yeshiva of Flatbush? Wasn't that established in the 20s?
Yeshiva Flatbush, I'm not 100% sure. I believe it was in the late 20s.
Because I think Rebbetzin Wolf, may she rest in peace, went there.
Yes, yes. I believe it was the late 20s, and also around the same time was Yeshiva of Crown Heights. Yeah. There were yeshivot, modern-style yeshivot, that were established in interwar Brooklyn. We'll session on interwar Brooklyn.
Okay. Eitz Chaim in Borough Park.
And Eitz Chaim of Borough Park, 13th Avenue and 50th.
You bet.
That was the big one.
And down the block was Shalamas.
Correct, correct. Shalamas was 1941. Okay.
And in Queens, it was Dove Revel.
Your alma mater.
My alma mater.
All right, take care, everybody.